Oh, you're on In Conversation with Scotty Stevenson, a Rugby Pass podcast. As we await the return of the short ball, we thought it would be a great chance to catch up with some of the personalities who make up New Zealand's national game. And joining us on the line is Richard Turner, two-test All Black and TV personality these days, and a great colleague and friend of mine. Pod, good day to you, sir.
G'day, Sue, mate.
Richard Turner, I'm going to take you way back to start our conversation. Hey, way back. To...
Just before you go too far back, Scotty, you know that I've taken a few knocks to the head.
Yeah, so, haven't we all, mate? Haven't we all? I'm going to take you back to Napier Men's High School, Napier Boys High School. You would have been the biggest fella running around on that paddock, surely, Pod?
At my particular school, yeah, I was. There's no doubt about that. In fact, that was kind of that was me growing up, you know. I'm going to take us back even further. You know, I think one of my endearing memories of growing up, you know, like all, or I won't say all because that's probably a little bit arrogant, but like most kids growing up in my era, you know, we couldn't get into footy quick enough, and I started playing as a 4-year-old, and I think from the age of 4 to about 8 years old, all I can recall from those days playing wise is my mum on the sideline going, he's only four, because I was that much bigger than everyone else. You know, like, oh, you know, what parents are, oh, what's that big kid doing playing against all these other kids?
I've had the pleasure of dinner time at Sina Turner's, and I'm not surprised you were bigger than most other kids. She can put on a feed, your mum.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, there was no shortage of that. So I did a lot of carbo loading from an early age.
Mate, when did you get serious about footy and about thinking about it as something you wanted to do representatively?
I think probably those days. I bought the boys' high days. Obviously, you know, making the Napier boys' first 15, and then, you know, but all of a sudden you're sort of attracting attention and around that that age group system, and also remembering Hawke's Bay, you know, age group wise was huge, massively dominant at under 16 level and under 18, which subsequently became 17 to 19. So. I guess it was around that, and then I think probably when in my last year at Napier Boys First 15, when I got picked up to play the tail end of the then NPC competition for Hawke's Bay as a schoolboy, you know, that was probably when it was like, I was like, okay, it's, you know, this is. You know, this is probably time to start getting reasonably serious about, you know, like, as I say, like getting serious about, you know, obviously, you know, the dreams of you know, of higher honours. And it was probably around that time. And I think also now, and it's probably more prevalent now, you know, as a kid growing up, I was into everything and anything, you know, sporting wise. And you know, and I think you're probably forced into making some decisions at high school because you know, it was like, oh, you couldn't do everything. So it was like, oh, if you're in the first 15, you couldn't play basketball anymore. So it was kind of, you know, almost, you know, not forced into making that choice, but that's when it was, yeah, one of those times where it's deciding whether or not I wanted to be serious about being a rugby player.
You know, it's one of our other conversations during this series was with Leon McDonald, who was also picked for his provincial side while still a schoolboy. What was the experience like for you? Because he would have been a back, he'd be able to hide a bit more, but he said even in the first even in the first 30 seconds of his debut game for Marlborough, I think he had a black eye and probably a broken nose. So, I mean, what was it like for you running out there? Because these were tough, tough men.
Yeah, and exactly, that's exactly what they were. Sumo, they were men, you know, and I was quite literally a snotty nosed schoolboy, albeit that, you know, I was 6'4" and 118 kilos, so I was small, but yeah, I was still a boy, but and you know, I was literally going out there to play against men. But the one thing I had that obviously Leon McDonald wasn't privy to, and was I had a guy in my team called Mark Shaw.
Yeah, that would have helped.
So, it certainly did because, he basically took it upon himself to essentially be my minder. so my introduction to first class rugby was essentially running around pretty much behind Mark Shaw, making sure if I got stuck at the bottom of the ruck, he wasn't too far away. And I can tell you that he got me out of a few sticky situations. So, yeah, he was my saving grace, no doubt about it.
For those who are listening overseas, just explain a little bit about Mark Shaw to them.
Well, you talk about hard men. He was, you know, he was a genuinely, you know, he was a tough bugger. He came off the land and he was pretty raw. He referred to university students or educated people as scarf draggers. there wasn't a lot of room in Mark Shaw's life for those sort of people. But you know, he was a good footy player, but he was a tough, uncompromising footy player. But again, you know, he in old school, so I was, because I was obviously the youngest in the side, we went away on my first actual game for Hawke's Bay was an away game to the King Country. We two up in a room, and in those days, a queen bed and a single bed shared. And I walked into the room and immediately put my bag by the single bed, sort of thinking that's my place. And Cowboy walked in and said, "No, boy, you need your sleep. You get in the big bed, I'm okay in the little bed." and then, as I say, he took it upon himself, and had a huge amount of respect from other players, and that was certainly comforting from my perspective, because as with the conversation I had with Leon, you know, there were some grisly old rugby players that didn't take too kindly to young upstarts trying to ply their way in our national game. So it was certainly great for me to have Mark Shaw quite literally covering my back.
Yeah, it's not a bad guy I have covering for you. Certainly someone who's compared often to the likes of Cal Tremaine and Ian Kirkpatrick. So that's not a bad guy to have in your team. Of course, he'd also go on to coach Hawke's Bay in the early 2000s as well, Cowboy Shaw. And I know subsequently in your career, you toured with him, didn't you, to Canada? I think he took a team away.
We did.
And the other side of him was revealed on that tour.
Yeah, it certainly was. I mean, it was 1990. So the All Blacks had gone to France. The All Blacks were touring France, and we were like essentially a junior All Black team, and we went off to Canada. But the Canadian Rugby Union, it was probably one of the first official New Zealand rugby union teams to head to Canada. So they made quite a big deal about it, and in fact, they gave us the moniker of the future All Blacks team, and we spent a number of probably 35 hours getting to the east coast of Canada. We started over the far side of Canada, and we arrived at some ungodly hour of the morning, and there was every Canadian rugby official and his blazer and tie that was in existence at the time met, and Lane Penn was our coach. You know, he stood up in front of all these Canadian officials and made sure he said all the right things, and you know that this is important, and the All Blacks are in France, so you know you're the next cab off the rank. So you know it's important you all play well for not only you know your immediate future, but down the track. And almost as an afterthought, he sort of got up and said to Cowboy, have you got anything you want to say? And Cowboys was very short, very succinct, and probably something I can't repeat. But it was it kind of set the tone for the rest of the tour, Scotty. And well, I think the closest the Canadians got to us was about 40 to 50 points, and we certainly had a very enjoyable trip.
Well, it was only a couple of years later, Pod, where you finally cracked that All Black side, and it was during the series, the centenary series in 1992, and you played your first and only two test matches for the All Blacks. And we'll get to reasons why they were your only two tests in just a moment, but that feeling of having made it, having been around the system, having played with these guys and finally running out there as an All Black, do you still look back on that now with absolute sincere fondness?
Oh, 100%. And I was, you know, for me, it was sort of made even more special because back in that was early 90s, we still had All Black trials. So we went through an All Black trial system, and it was in my hometown in Napier. So I'd moved to North Harbour by then, and was prior my trade with North Harbour under the guidance of Peter Thorburn, and we all went back to the Hawke's Bay, and it was I think we played a trial match on a Friday, and then from that they picked a possibles and a probables team, and the probables were essentially a New Zealand 15 team, and they were the guys that were favoured to be selected for the All Blacks, and I've obviously had a pretty good first trial and got named as number 8 in that New Zealand 15 side, the probables, and we promptly got beaten by the possibles.
I remember this.
But you know, obviously hometown and all my family there, and we finished that final trial and all showered up, and then went through to the Centennial Hall for the aftermatch function, and that's they actually named the All Black side for that centenary series in the hall at the aftermatch functions, and so I had my mum and dad there and a lot of my family, so that sort of doubled down in terms of the occasion for me, you know, to do it in front of my, you know, my hometown friends and family was an amazing feeling and something, you know, it's that I'll never forget. It was certainly, you know, that and because you're a Turner, starting with T, then teams named alphabetically, yeah. You have to wait a long time.
You do.
To hear your name.
Yeah, you do.
And so it was, and my mum was holding my hands, and my mum's got her fingernails are about 3 or 4 inches long, so they were quite, you know, as the names are read out, digging deeper and deeper into my hand, and I thought I was going to be injured out of the team even if I had been selected because I had 3-inch fingernails stuck in my hand. So, mate, it was massively special, and then obviously then to get together and then to go into a room, because essentially, yeah, you got taken into a room. All those that were named went into a room and you know, all of a sudden you're sitting in a room with, you know, even though you played against them, they were, you know, you still idolised a lot of those, you know, legendary All Blacks, Fitzpatrick's, the Kerwins of the world. And all of a sudden you're sitting next to them going, man, this is pretty cool. I'm an All Black, and I'm in the All Blacks, and I'm sitting next to you know, a legendary All Black. So, yeah, mate, it was a pretty special time.
I'm just going to run through the opposition that day in Christchurch Pod, your test debut on the 18th of April, 1992. The captain of the team, Sol, playing loosehead prop, Phil Kearns, Peter Fatialofa, Session Rumah, Offahin Garway, McKinnon White, Nickel, Kambettle Bettle, Hendricks, Horan, Guscott, Notza and Hastings. It's a hell of a lineup of international players to come up against, and I don't need to remind you, they had the better of you that day.
They did. Lost that test, Scotty, and Christchurch. So, you know, it was, again, the next, you know, after getting named, the next coolest thing about an All Black is being in a change room and being given your jersey and then pulling it on and running out onto the field as an All Black and becoming one of the club. That's pretty special. But, yeah, it was a tough game. And obviously we hadn't been together that long. The star-studded world system got together and put us away. I managed to dot down though, so that was pretty cool.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, it's got a photo. In fact, it was a Herald photographer that took the photo, actually sent it to me. So you know, I've got that big photo of me scoring in the corner at Lancaster Park, proudly displayed on the wall, and that was pretty cool. Even though we did lose the game, and I got dropped for the second test.
yeah. Sorry about that, mate. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, all right.
I wasn't there, obviously, but that's okay. I was just thinking because you and Ingatuga Mala were the try scorers that day. I think you're probably the two biggest All Blacks. One playing number 8, one playing on the left wing.
That's right. Yeah, we were also 1 and 2 on the buffet line.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough too. I think of that team, though, and you can't have a conversation with you about rugby without bringing North Harbour up, because it would have been a big move for you in a lot of ways to go to North Harbour, which was still a very young province at that stage. What was behind the decision? Was it just a rugby decision, or was it time for Big Richard to go to the Big Smoke?
In 1988, I was playing for Hawke's Bay against Tony Welsh, so I broke my arm. Mm. And then So I had a bit of time to sort of take stock of what was going on, and decided I'm a Hawke's Bay boy, so Hawke's Bay was my world, and decided that there might be a bigger world out there, and moved up to came up here for a holiday to Auckland for a holiday. I only knew one bloke in Auckland at the time, that was Tim Barry, because he'd been away on a rugby New Zealand youth team trip with him. Mm-hmm. And he picked me up from the airport and showed me around the big city, and ended up at the North Coast, it's the old sliding doors thing, it's interesting how life pans out, but he said, look, I've got to go to my local rugby club just for a registration evening. Why don't you come along and have a beer, stand in the corner and behave yourself? And at the time, that was the time where Brad Morant, who subsequently went on to coach North Harbour and was a massive influence in my career and a bloody good bloke as well. He had come to Northcote from another club on the North Shore at that time, and a whole handful of guys had sort of come into the club as well. A couple of guys had come across the bridge, and Brad sort of got in my ear and said, what are you doing here? What are your thoughts? What are your plans? And between him and Peter Thorburn convinced me that the big smoke was the place to be, and I just kept reminding him at the time that there was to be honest with you, I was a big fish in a small pond in the Hawke's Bay, and I'd come up to a very big pond that was Greater Auckland and North Harbour, and there was a bloke swimming around in the North Harbour pond called Wayne Shelford. So I was sort of saying to them, can't see myself playing very much, and they quite rightly convinced me. Initially you might not play a lot, but who better to be an understudy to and learn the art of being a number eight than from Wayne Shelford? So they did a pretty good job convincing me, and decided that was probably the next step in my rugby career, albeit that it was hard to leave home and leave mum's cooking. Scotty, I decided that was what I wanted to do. So I moved up here at the age of 19.
Yeah. And were they right? Was Buck Shelford a big influence? Was he the best guy to learn off?
Yeah, massive. I mean, he was obviously a great player, and for me, in terms of your attitude and your dedication, he certainly set a benchmark for that. But he was probably in that respect, because it was obviously an amateur era, well before professional. But Buck had a real his whole life was dedicated to being the best he could be on the rugby field. And at the time, it was really interesting because, don't get me wrong, I love being a rugby fan, I love rugby, but, I was a Hawke's Bay boy that had come up to the big city, and so the bright lights in the big city, there was all this other world that sort of was, I'm looking at going, I haven't seen this before, that looks quite appealing as well. Where Buck was 100% dedicated to being a rugby player, and he probably trained like a professional well before professionalism, so... It was a good thing to sit there and be an understudy to him and saying, okay, well, he's obviously the best in his position, and that's what it takes to be there. So that they were certainly good learnings.
86 games you played for North Harbour through those years, mate, and you mentioned Brad Morant already and Peter Thorburn, and I know those two coaches certainly had their share of funny moments, but... I mean, I look through the personalities in that team and dead set, it's probably the funniest collection of blokes ever put in the same Guernseys and sent out onto a playing field. What was it like to be around the likes of Walter Little and Frank Bunce and Eric Rush and Blair Larson and so many others?
For 80 minutes on a rugby field, it was fantastic. great guys, but just... unbelievably talented, and I think if we look back on it and we've all been honest with ourselves, we probably didn't really really reach our potential as a side, but that was because we had such strong personalities there that those guys loved rugby, loved playing the game, but also loved everything else that came with the game at the time as well. So you know, yeah, we had we probably had too much fun, if I was being honest. But you know, we also had a saying that it was sort of boots on, switch on. So, you know, we managed to, at times, and clearly from a coach's perspective, probably not consistent and never often enough for a coach. But you know, there were times when we did put our boots on that we went pretty good, and you know, playing in a team with those guys was just, you know, that was special. And sometimes you just found yourself quite literally standing in the middle of the paddock going, oh, I wonder where this is going to end up, you know. And sometimes it was pretty spectacular. And we certainly had a lot of fun, and the game was different. And you know, the first time I went into a change room after a Harbour game, you know, that you know, the first thing a lot of guys did was spark a gasper and grab a can of Iron Red. You know, and that was like, they were like, oh, geez, thanks, that's what I need to get to recover from this game. So obviously things have changed since then, but you know, yeah, we had that attitude. We worked hard and we played hard, and it was certainly a really enjoyable 89 to 96. I left the country, and so that was a pretty 86 games, and all of them very, very enjoyable.
I understand that Pete Thorburn once got so frustrated with you that he waited for an age. You were huddling at halftime on the field. Teams didn't go back into the changing rooms, and he took his time, so much time, running out or walking out to talk to you that by the time he got there, the referee blew his whistle and said second half starts, and he just turned around and walked away again.
Well, he used to always, Forbes used to actually say that should be what a good coach does. He times his walk to get out there and time to turn around and walk back again. And I think part of that was often, you know, that probably 90% of the things that he said went in one ear of most of our guys and out the other. And you know, I was captain of that mob for a long time. You know, it was it was interesting times. You know, it certainly wasn't in terms of motivating them and getting the best out of them. They weren't traditional methods, and often you just had to run with it. And as I say, as a coach, they were sitting in the stands tearing their hair out. But you know, you couldn't temper that because often that's what got the best out of those guys when they were given the ball. You know, and it was pretty special to be a part of.
The Battle of the Bridge final, Richard Turner. If any game stands out in North Harbour's history, it is it's that famous game against Auckland at Oniwa Domain, and everything about it was an act of violence.
Those dirty Aucklanders.
yeah, and none of you have ever forgotten, I don't think. 1994, and it was the season climax, and it was the first time you guys had hosted a final. And the Aucklanders believed that it should be played at Eden Park. You guys dug your toes in and said, nah, it's been played at Oniwa.
Still arrogant. They were arrogant then, still are now, Scotty.
Talk to me about that week and that game briefly, if anyone can remember
it. Simplify it. It was essentially a big old pot of rugby that was on a burner, and the whole week we just kept chucking things at each other in this pot that was you know, one side antagonising the other side, and it went to extreme. So those were the days when we were both sponsored by Nike, and Nike didn't mind spending a dollar promoting an event, and they put up there was a billboard on opposite.
That was on the downtown shopping centre.
Yeah, the downtown shopping centre that basically wrapped in an L shape around one side of the street, around the corner, and then down the other side of the street. They put up a billboard that said, "This town ain't big enough for the both of us." And there were Harbour guys on one side and Auckland guys on the other side. And then the week just came. But basically, the Aucklanders were like, mate, you know, anyway, you can't play an NPC final only with the main. It's a disgrace. And we're like, well, no, too bad. We've earned the right to be there. And so you guys are going to come across and play us in our turf. And essentially, for those that didn't know, Onewa Domain was basically a club ground.
Yeah.
So it was a Takapuna rugby club ground that, you know, that on during the rep season converted to North Harbour's home ground. So if you can imagine, the changing rooms weren't, they weren't big changing rooms, and certainly far from today's standard. Mm. And there were a couple of luxuries for the home team, and that they got a slightly bigger one. But we took great delight in poking Auckland into the smallest rooms available, changing rooms available. And I think amongst the, I would have had 21 players in those days. I think they had to spread amongst three changing rooms to get themselves all in there. So we just took great delight in that. The whole week though was pretty antagonistic, and then it culminated in a massive crowd, which was great, running out on the field, and then there was a fair bit of we knew that they were. Yeah, they were the favourites. There's no doubt about that, and they had a bloody good team, to be fair to them. But our attitude was we weren't going to. They were the arrogant big brother, and we were going to be snotty-nosed little brother that wasn't going to take a back foot. And that pot that I referred to previously, Scotty, about 30 seconds into the game, that kind of boiled over.
A little bit.
And then we couldn't get the lid back on it.
I see clips of that game so often, and you can see clips of that online still. Man, there were some acts of thuggery in that game. It's actually remarkable. Yep. I mean, there's never been a game since in New Zealand rugby, and there never will be because you just couldn't do that now. But yeah, I always think it's well worth remembering how much feeling was, even though that feeling may have been slightly misdirected in the game. It's always worth remembering from a provincial point of view how much that meant and how special that rivalry had become.
Oh, absolutely. And we also had guys that had come from the other side of the bridge,
yeah,
the dark side, we call it, living on the North Shore. They'd come from the dark side, they'd come over to us, and they copped it from Walker. Oh, you're not good enough to play for us, so that's why you've gone to Harbour. Mm. I think that a lot of it was actually those guys didn't enjoy that environment,
yeah.
So they came over to us because they looked over the fence and went, oh, actually, that's a cool environment to be a part of. We want to be a part of it. So they came over and they obviously copped a bit as well. So, oh look, and if you talk to anyone involved in that game, and the guys are involved in some of the unsavory incidents, they were real anomalies. Like they were guys that had illustrious careers and probably never ever behaved like that on a rugby field before.
Yeah.
And they just did things that they were just honestly, as a skipper, I'm sort of going, okay, I know we weren't going to take a step back, but we've probably taken steps forward here, fellas. But there was so much emotion, so much at stake in the game that, it quite literally, there was no controlling it.
Now, Pod, cutting a long story short, you went away to Italy and then subsequently to Japan after your playing career here had finished. You captained the Chiefs in their first year of existence in Super Rugby and then went and plied your trade. You've done many things since then, but I guess for most New Zealanders and international listeners as well, what you've made your name in over the last decade especially is in your television work. Do you still look at the game with the same sense of wonder and the same joy that you did as a young kid running around in Hawke's Bay?
Oh, look, I think I certainly look at it. Yeah, I mean, I look at it in awe now because the game has changed so much, and the guys playing the game now, man. Physically, they're bigger, they're stronger, they're faster, but. I mean, those guys now, we used to marvel at the Walter Littles and the Frank Bunts and the Glenn Osbournes and they they were talented players. But I'm looking at guys now, and not only guys at the top level, Scotty, we've been fortunate enough, you and I, to go down to our National Under-19 tournament. Mm. And the depth of talent in this country, rugby playing-wise, is just phenomenal. It really is. And those guys, the influence of professionals being huge in the game, and so guys are becoming athlete focused at a really young age. So therefore, their skill development is just unbelievable. Out of the world. So I sit there now and just, and I've been lucky, mate. I've been lucky to sit in that Sky chair for I think it's 15, 16 years now. I'm not saying this, it's a real privilege to sit there and I'll tell you what, it's also a lot easier to sit there and tell people how they should be playing it rather than being out there in the middle doing it. But it is, mate, it's a privilege to be to be able to do that. And over 60 years, I've made to see some of the talent and and guys that have come through our game that have gone on to the greater fights of the game, but also guys that, you know, that you see that you don't see again. You know, it's amazing. And you know, and I still enjoy our national provincial competition now. It's called the Mitre 10 Cup now, and you know, every year I look forward to it because every year it just spits out the next generation of talent, and that talent, you know, I just think, well, I guess I sit there and philosophically, I wonder where this can end. You know, how good can a rugby player be? Mm. You know, there must be a limit on the things that a player can do on a rugby field, but. No, every year somebody else does something that you know, where did that come from and how did you learn to do that?
I tell you why I asked you like the Mitre 10 Cup pod, because you get back to Hawke's Bay for Cena Turner's dinners. And I wish you many more with that wonderful woman, mate, and I thank you for joining us for In Conversation today.
Pleasure, Scotty.
Thank you very much, mate. Richard Turner joining us on In Conversation, a series of podcasts as we await the return of the short ball on rugbypass.com.